Hello, podcast listeners. A brief announcement before we begin this program. We'd like to invite you all to join us for a very special 20th annual Austin Film Festival and Conference. That's October 24th through the 31st to experience on-story panels in person and get a first-hand look behind the scenes of some of your favorite films and TV shows with their inspiring creators. Get your badge at austinfilmfestival.com and enter the code PODCAST for $25 off a producer's badge. That's austinfilmfestival.com. Enter the code PODCAST for $25 off and we'll see you there in October. We'd also like to remind everyone to search Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast in the iTunes store and rate and review this program. It's quick, it's easy, and it'll help us keep bringing you this great content. On to the podcast. Today on Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast, a conversation with Jay and Mark Duplass.
I think it's hard to make good movies.
Yeah.
I think right. It's hard to make stuff that doesn't suck.
If you're going to ask somebody for $6 million to make a weird movie, you better goddamn work it to the bone and deliver them something.
Brothers Jay and Mark Duplass are often associated with mumblecore, a subgenre of independent film characterized by low-budget production, amateur actors, and naturalistic dialogue. These two multi-talented filmmakers have since graduated to a larger scale with 2010's Cyrus, which features John C. Reilly, Marissa Tomei, and Jonah Hill, 2011's Jeff Who Lives at Home, starring Jason Segel and Ed Helms, and the upcoming HBO series Togetherness, which premieres in 2014. The two have continued to make small independent films despite their successes. Today's podcast was recorded at the 18th Annual Austin Film Festival on October 22nd, 2011.
We did grow up being creative kids and shooting with multi-parted VCR, you know, like the camera separate from the VTR. Yes. But we were not talented. If you went back to our student films or our kid films, they didn't show anything promising or interesting.
If you look at the early Coen Brothers movies that they made with Sam Raimi and Bruce, you'll be like, okay, there's a lot of talent there. You can see it.
Yeah.
That's not the case.
Not at all.
At all.
One movie was starring Mark, who was 6 years old, and he owned a house.
A 2,500 square foot home in the suburbs of New Orleans,
and
in fact.
And he walked around the house wearing a karate gi.
It was right after Karate Kid came out,
absolutely,
by the way.
Yeah. So he would just walk around the house smoking a cigarette, just kind of owning the house. And then our next door neighbor, Brant, busted into the house, beat his ass, and then later could be seen lifting weights.
Yeah, he kind of took over the house.
He did. He took over the house, yeah.
And then I came back and jumped on him while he was lifting weights, and then there was a real, quote, cinema verite cut to moment of him with a steak knife with some ketchup on it. It already had the ketchup on it before he stabbed me. It was like pre-blood.
Right.
And he looked at me in the eyes, and I remember this is where Jay really started to get good with the camera, because I think he reframed it, and we did like a take two on it. He looked at me, and he said, "These days, you cannot trust anyone."
Boom. And the entire film was 41 seconds long.
The other film was about 8 seconds, and it was a remake of The Blob, and we threw our big blue beanbag down the stairs.
But didn't it eat you? Or we tried
it
to
got
make
on
it,
me at a certain point. It,
yeah.
I think we cut that. That was the director's cut.
Yeah, exactly.
But it wasn't until This Is John where we made something that we thought was, I guess, capable of being shown and not being laughed at. And it was this very particular thing because we went to film school at University of Texas, and that was kind of the time when, you know, Rodriguez and Linklater were like our heroes, you know, and it was almost the time when it was not cool to be in film school, when you were supposed to be renegade and off on your own. And so we did that, and in the mid-90s we went off and made a lot of movies on our own, and they were very derivative. There were a lot about us trying to be other filmmakers. We try to emulate the Coen brothers or emulate, you know, Rocky or something, and they were just second-rate, bad, derivative, nothing personal in it, and we got very depressed, and we were like, you know, because we were raised like Catholic school prep boys, and all of our friends were like rich and in business, and we were like living together in South Austin in a $600 a month apartment, like, it was looking bad there for a minute. Like, we're not gonna make this. And then one morning we were just like, okay, what if we just like get back to what we loved about filmmaking, like when we were kids? Like, let's get rid of the crew. Let's get rid of all the things we learned. Like, you get on the camera again, and I'll act again, and we'll just make something today. And Jay came up with this great concept, which was something that had happened to him. He had tried to record the personal greeting of his answering machine, and he couldn't get it right, and he almost had an emotional breakdown. And it was like, that's great. That's like relatable.
Thanks
it's funny.
For saying,
yeah.
Thanks for saying almost.
Yeah. Almost.
They don't need to know the truth.
They don't need to know the truth. Yeah. And then literally, like, we picked up like the crappiest, you know, camcorder you could imagine, and I just put on some of his roommate's clothes, went out the door, and I was like, turn the camera on. I'm coming in. And we shot one 20-minute take, and I think it was all of our frustrations and everything, and we just blasted through that. And it is the most poorly lit, terrible sounding, poorly framed. There's a dead pixel in it. I mean, it is professionally speaking, a total turd. And then we edited it down to like 8 minutes, and that was our first movie that got into Sundance. And it, you know, cost us $3, and it was like a big lesson for us that made us realize, like, okay, I think what we have to offer is, you know, basically putting these thinly veiled versions of ourselves and our experiences up, and as seriously as we take them, you know, let people laugh at and with them and have fun with it. And it was that comedy drama blend of that. And we basically have stuck to that model today. It's just, let's try and put acting and story first and foremost. And it's okay if the film isn't beautiful. People will like it if it's got something like honest in it, I guess.
You're in film school and you forget that filmmaking is about, you know, offering something unique and creative, and you just work on lighting for a while and you're like, there's like 700 DPs right. that are amazing. Like, who cares if right. you can light decently well? And, you know, we were just trying to, we would get sidetracked, and we were also in bands and stuff. I mean, we were just like blindly just trying to like not suck
right.
bad. You know what I mean? It was like, please God, don't let this suck as bad as we normally do. You know, that was seriously the internal dialogue of what we were
just
going
shooting
through.
For a good solid C minus.
Yeah. Basically. And I mean,
that's really,
and I'm not, he's not joking. And I think it's important also to note that like the period that he was talking about from that Karate Man movie until we made This Is John was like 15 to 20 years. Right. I mean, it was, you know, most people thought when we came out with This Is John and the Puppy Chair that we were in our early 20s, but like
we were 65 years old. Yeah,
exactly. Midlife crisis. We had already, yeah. At the end of our movies, usually something happens where somebody really rejects someone else, or they accept them when they're on the brink of rejection or something like that. And I think the biggest lesson we learned is that that's enough, you know, as long right. as it's genuine. You know, what we make films about now, they're the private conversations that Mark and I have had always throughout our whole lives about the really like embarrassing passive aggressive things we did to our girlfriends, or like, did you hear what Jeff said to Fred? That was ridiculous. And then we cringe in this drama, and then we start giggling about it. And right. it's like, oh, but we never thought that that was film worthy. But we put it out there, and people were cringing and laughing, and some people were crying and getting angry with someone next to them that was laughing. And it was like, we basically just made fun of ourselves on film, and then all of a sudden all the critics were saying everything we wanted them to say before, when all we were doing is just kind of like redoing this ridiculous experience that had happened to me.
Right. You know, and I'll just speak bluntly, like no like false modesty, whatever. Like, This Is John was a hit out of Sundance. It was, right. and people were talking about it because it was like, this is a $3 movie. It's the cheapest movie in the festival. It's inspired. We're getting back to Cassavetes. You know, it was, everybody was talking about it. We got the biggest, best agent in Hollywood. And basically we were at that crossroads where it was like, okay, now we can spend our time trying to read scripts from other writers and trying to find one that we would have to vie to direct, like go make a pitch for, you know. And we talked to a lot of people like Rick and Linklater, and we call him Rick, you know, because we're buds. and we got a lot of advice from people saying that's a very, very dangerous game, because you can spend your whole career just waiting around to get the right script, or you can even write your own script. And they have something called packaging that the agencies love to tell you about, which is, we'll get a bunch of actors from our agency, and then we'll take it out and we'll sell it and set it up, and you can get caught in packaging for like 7 years, and you just like never make a movie. And that scared us. So yeah. We decided to take the route, This Is John worked for us, let's stick with what we know. It only had one person in it. Let's make a short with two people in it. We'll just take like a step up. And so we made this short Scrabble that was me and my girlfriend, or my wife my girlfriend at the time, you know, and it was about a passive aggressive fight that couples have over board games. Again, that sort of small thing that we all know and understand.
We still said it in a kitchen, though.
Yeah, it was in the kitchen.
We just added one person.
There was a boom operator on this one.
Oh, that's true. A boom person.
This one cost $100. This was big time. And that went to Sundance, and that really further solidified for us, like, we feel like we should make a relationship movie, that sort of mid-20s relationship movie. So yeah. We wrote The Puffy Chair very quickly after that, and our agent was like, let's take it out and let's sell it. Let's set it up. Let's go talk to Ryan Gosling. Let's go talk to this person. And we just felt like, I don't know if it was fear-based or what it was, and it wasn't really a hard decision, but it was just like, we should do this exactly like we made our two shorts. We should go out, we should make it. If it stinks, better for it to stink at $15,000 than like our chance at making a $5 million movie.
Right.
We screw it up, they'll never have us back.
Right.
So we went ahead and made Puffy Chair the same way. And then now look at us. I mean, look at this. There's lights on us.
There it is. We have our own lighting, guys. Everywhere we go.
The Puffy Chair, Baghead, and the process of making Cyrus.
We started it in March of 04. We wrote it in a couple of months. We went out and filmed it in June and July. We edited it in 3 months, and then we took it to Sundance the next year. I mean, it was crazy.
It's probably the best thing we ever did for our career.
Oh, like, yeah.
Because, I mean, I guess there's a chance we could have gotten that movie made. There was a little bit of heat
behind us.
But it was always that sort of when in doubt thing, just like take the sure road. We've always taken that. I mean, in some ways, it's, you can look at it as like an aggressive approach, but it's almost a conservative approach by saying like, I'm just going to make sure that we're putting movies out in the world, and it's like blue chip stocks. Like,
right.
We know we can make this movie. Let's just do it. You know,
part of our creative procedure is to eliminate the brain as much as possible from the whole process. Is like, don't think about it too much. Like, just keep making stuff. And Mark is much better at pushing us forward because I'm brainier with it. But the reality is like,
I have no brain, you guys.
Yeah.
I'm the Rocky, he's the Bullwinkle.
Yeah.
This is how it happens.
Thinking about art is not making art. It's very different. Not that art doesn't require cognition and lots of thoughtfulness, but, you know, as we all know, we can spend like a couple of years thinking about stuff, and then you're like, wait, I didn't make anything. I've just been thinking about stuff. I was kind of like more the film guy and in film school, and I was like, we need a 16mm camera.
Right.
And Mark was like, no, let's just make stuff. Let's just make stuff and rely on our ability to figure it out in the moment. And that's, interestingly enough, has like defined our process even in studio filmmaking. Is like, we show up on set and we do have a script, but like we don't feel like we're 95% there when like the sets are there and the actors actually show up. And, you know, I think that's how a lot of people feel, is that it's built, the script has been written, and we got the good actors and they're going to do their performances and everything, you know, so we're going to have a nice time on set. We get on set and we're miserable. Like, people are like, you guys, your movies look real fun. You almost have a lot of fun on set. And we're like, no, we hate it. It's awful, because we feel like when we show up on set, we're like, we are 5% there and we got to get it all. You know, it's all about getting magic when it happens. And
it's very painful. It's very
extremely
hard.
Painful, but
when you get it, it's incredibly invigorating.
It's the best thing in the world.
The last two movies we made were with studio money, so that's a little bit more pressure. Great responsibility, great opportunity to, like, you know, so many more people saw our last movie, Cyrus, than saw any of our other movies combined, and that's great. We are not Martin Scorsese. Like, he sees the whole movie in his head. And when he's on set, he's just like, well, let's just walk through it. I know exactly what this movie is.
Right.
We're editing in our heads as we go, and we're kind of rewriting some of the dialogue. We're like, oh, he said that. He made it all about the toaster this time. So now we got to bring the toaster in. Let's put the toaster in scene 68. But, you know, you're just kind of like, it sounds cheesy, but it's like jazz, where you're like, all the players are showing up. They know the song. They know we're playing in the key of A. But the notes you play and how and when you decide to go from part A to B to C is about eye contact and connection and trying to figure that whole thing out.
Did you hear that? We're like jazz musicians, guys.
Well, I consider myself more of a Coltrane.
Okay. It's just trying to get that level of naturalism that we're looking for. You know, we're looking for people to be really having moments with each other and talking to each other in the moment. So it's remarkable how similar it comes out to the script in the end, but it allows for a lot more subtlety. And I also feel like it is more about what people are psychologically and subconsciously doing to each other as opposed to the specific intellectual dialogue or
whatever. They're just on their toes more.
They're on their toes, yeah. You can't be expecting a line because you know that this person across from you could do anything to you at any time. And I think also subconsciously, audiences, even though they might not articulate it, I think they feel that. They feel that sense of like, oh man, anything, this, I don't know what's going to happen right here. And it's because when we filmed it, John C. Reilly did not know what was going to happen to him or whoever it was. You know, he had that fear in his eye that was real. You know, from that moment. And it sucks for him. Yeah. It sucks so bad because that's the thing. It's like every, you know, typically they're like, oh, we're going to have such a good time, man. It's Duplass Brothers set. We're going to wing some humdinger lines out there. We're going to probably be smoking some weed. I mean, who knows? And it's like, no, they come on set and they're just like, I'm fucking terrified. They're just like, can we just do like one scene?
No, that's where John calls you into his trailer.
Yeah.
He says, come talk to me. And we're like, oh no, what's he gonna do? And there were moments where they're like, is there a movie here? Like, what are we doing here?
Right.
You know? And we just have to say to him and to the studio and to our producers, like, I know this is hard, but you're gonna have to trust us because a lot of this is instinctual and it's going on in our brains. And we lament that we're putting you in this position where you kind of have to blindly trust us, but like, that is a little bit a part of it.
And then I walk into the trailer with Mark and I say, do we have a movie here?
Do we have a movie? And you say,
we were like developing a bunch of movies and they were taking a long time. Cyrus was one of them. But
it was like the first time we were able to make money as filmmakers.
Right.
And so we spent a little time doing that and we developed a couple of different things and finally made some money. And then we wrote Baghead and there was a chance for us to do it at sort of these sort of smaller studios, like the Lionsgate type studios that make horror films. And it was, you know, it was a good time for that. And we got very close to making it with, I would say, with one studio in particular and then one independent financier in particular, both at astronomically higher budget levels than what we made it for. But in the end, it was, you know, I mean, it sounds cliche, but like for the studio version to work out, it would have had to have become much more clearly a bloody horror movie.
Right.
And that was just not what the movie was supposed to be. And then the independent financier level was like, you know, just for those of you who are interested in the nuts and bolts of these kinds of things, like we knew we could make Baghead for about 50 grand in the can, you know, and we knew it would sell well and above and beyond that. So for that, we wanted to own the whole movie. We wanted to put our own money into it and be the owners of it.
Right.
You know, why let somebody pay for it for 50 grand? They'll own half the movie, do nothing, and they'll make all your money. It's like, no, we should own this. But we did say, any financier who wants to give us a $250,000 check for this movie, no questions asked, you get a movie from people who've made a movie that went to Sundance that sold, and you'll do well. And we had so many people come in and be like, yes, we totally want to do that. And we were like, just to be clear, this is literally, you write a check. You're the bank. You're not a creative part of the process. They're like, sure. And we'd take a meeting with them and they'd be like, what if he had a bag on his head because it was like a meth lab explosion? And we were like, or they would be like, yeah, we just want to send one of our line producers to set to make sure everything's going well. And every one of them were just like, look, you'll have a good deal here. And the movie sold for way above $250,000. We ended up making it on our own, and we did well by it.
Plus, everyone wanted to put famous people in the movie, and it's a movie about non-famous actors trying to get famous.
Right.
So you have like Tom Cruise going, I just can't make it, man. I just can't get my break. You know what I mean? It was like literally.
It's because you're too short, man, and you're weird. And you.
That's our version of Tom Cruise being in that movie. We actually started talking to Fox Searchlight, you know, very soon after the Puffy Chair in 2005. We didn't release Cyrus until when? 2010. So it was like a 5-year process, and we were talking to lots of other studios at the same time. We had to say no hundreds and hundreds of times. It sounds, you know, like high-class problems, but when we were broke and we were barely scraping by, it was one of the hardest things to do. Right after Puffy Chair, you know, people were very excited about our unique sense of humor and our ability to make stuff really cheap and small. And we were nice dudes, and we obviously could like handle some movie stars and stuff, which is also an issue in Hollywood. Like, what directors can get through a 4-month process
That's what they're looking for. Can you handle 90 minutes? Can you handle asshole movie stars? They check your qualities in the room, almost like,
right,
you know, like,
right, right.
How are you politically is almost as important as how you are creatively.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and like, they sized us up. They're like, ooh, they're a good fit.
Yeah,
like
the, right. You know?
So we got offered these like big, like romantic comedies where it'd be like, the script is okay. It needs a little work, so we can't get like a top-notch director for it.
Yeah.
We got Vince Vaughn attached. He's going to beat the living shit out of whatever director it is there. Guys, you want to direct this movie?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. They're just looking for somebody to get from A to Z because they'll
pay you $1 million, though.
They know that the movie's going to make money, but they pretty much know it's going to suck. But right. They don't care, and they want somebody who is personally and filmically capable of getting through the process. And Mark and I were like salivating puppies at their doors every time. And we probably went through this process, this very specific process where they would come, we would go meet with them, and they would tell us the idea. And it was exactly what Mark said. It was very commonly, this is a comedy, script has some problems, we got this one dude attached, we need to shoot it in March. If we don't get it done in March, the movie dies and we lose money. And so Mark and I would take the movie home, and we would destroy ourselves over the course of a week, taking this concept and making a concept that we felt had integrity and that we would be proud to make, but that still retained the elements of story that they had made before. And then what we would do is we'd go back in the next Monday and we would pitch them this story. Inevitably, what would happen is they would start cowering behind the desk, and they would we'd finish the pitch and they would say, guys, that was a beautiful story, but we are not going to make that. We're going to make this crappy one over here, and we deeply apologize to you guys.
Yeah, but when you're spending $40 million on a movie that has the commodity there, that's just how they think. You know, and they don't want to open up and crack the well and change everything because they might lose their movie star or their, you know.
Right.
So it's a very tricky process. So we quickly stopped doing that after a while.
We were just devastated every time. You know, it was just, oh fuck, that was a week's worth of like full-time work down the drain. You know, but what we later realized is that all those people became fans of ours and knew that we knew story and knew how to make a unique movie. And then later on, they would call us in and say, okay, what do you guys want to do?
Jay and Mark describe some of their influences, accepting success, and creating their film, Jeff Who Lives at Home.
We wrote that around 2006, like right after we made The Puffy Chair. And we felt like we weren't in a position, not only skill-wise, but even popularity-wise, to get that money to make it at that time. So we kind of put it in the drawer for the, like, let's make this when it's appropriate for our career. And that's something that, not to get too sidetracked, we really encourage filmmakers to do, is like try to make something that's the appropriate step for your career so you don't suffer trying to get something made that's just really not practical for you. Like, you know, there's an element of inspiration and then there's an element of just being practical about your career. And that was not practical then. So Cyrus is an interesting movie because it's actually quite a profitable movie for Fox Searchlight because they didn't spend a ton of money promoting it. We made it very cheaply by their standards. The DVD has done extremely well. So we were looked at as kind of like, you know, oh, this is like, this is a good game to get into with these guys. Like, you know, and we brought Jason Reitman on board as a producer for the film, who was kind of a bit of a social friend of ours. And he was really great in the upfront and was like, this movie is a little weird and it could get messed up so quickly at the studio. So he was basically like, let me use my Oscar nominated prowess to protect you guys through this process. You know, we got it set up with this really great company called Indian Paintbrush, who's this very rich gentleman named Steve Rails, who's gotten into movies, and he paid for the entire movie himself. And then we brought it to different studios to see who wanted to distribute it. So practically speaking, what that provided for us was the comfort and the creative freedom of being an independent film, which was funded by this guy, but with the security of having a studio behind it.
Right.
But because Paramount, who's our distributor, didn't pay for it, they weren't like on us every step of the way saying like, put him in better jeans.
Right.
The color of that pillow is terrible. Why does he have hair in his nose? This is terrible.
Mark and I cut Jason's hair for the movie. And that doesn't happen.
That says something.
Studios running your movie. What is that? Did you use the Flo-Bee? Yeah.
We've made like five movies in the last 5 years, and shit's looking a little grim in that drawer. Yeah. we need to start.
The sick part is the amount of ideas is out of control.
Right.
But we have a lot of stuff going on, so we don't necessarily have the time.
We've gotten busier, you know, too. Like, our lives used to be all about climbing the hill of independent film, and now it's like we're married, we have kids. I work 3 months a year on a TV show. Jay makes his own personal documentaries on the side. We've also started to work as like writers, like kind of script doctors in Hollywood, which is like the greatest gig ever in town. And like, we learned that from watching John Sayles' career, who would, you know, spend a month or two working on a monster movie as a scriptwriter and then go off and make his weird movies. And that was always the coolest model to us, is, you know, on some level, you're taking the financial burden off of your own films by not saying, I have to make a ton of money directing this movie. Because the more money you ask for, the more control there is on some level. He kind of like paved the way for a cool thing there. So we have a couple of things we're both writing right now. And I think our feeling is like, maybe we will not make a movie next year. Maybe we will like write some things and go swimming and do some of those things we have yet to do as we've been like, you know, banging our heads against the wall.
Right, right.
Not to over dramatize, but the amount of hard work, like, and sort of what we suffered through to get here and how hard we continue to work sometimes can get in the way of enjoying what it is that you're doing. So we try to stop each other every once in a while and be like, this is a privilege, and this, we're in a limo right now. What the frick is this? We're in a limo being taken to our movie. And we have to do that for each other a lot because we're obsessive, desperate people like the filmmakers in Baghead. I mean, that's how we are. Like, this is a really weird thing that I'm working through right now, is we're on a DGA panel in a month about the game changers of the last three decades, where Soderbergh is the 80s, Kimberly Pierce is the 90s, and Mark and I are the 2000s. And I can't believe it. I look at them two and I'm just like, yeah, they're awesome. We're two little farts who are making it up as we go. And it feels that way. And I've told a couple of my friends, and they're like, no, I think you guys are those people. And so you don't ever really think about it.
We will whore and sell out whatever principle possible to make a more entertaining movie at any minute of the day, including our own parents. But in terms of the real like inspirations, you know, it really was like us watching HBO as kids. You know, HBO kind of came into our house in the early 80s, and we just basically juiced up on that motherfucker. I mean, it was like, and it was at a time when they weren't curating the HBO time schedule like they do now. Put kids stuff in the morning, they put like, you know, the tweener stuff after school, and then the adult stuff at night now. Back then, you wake up Tuesday morning at 7 a.m., Kramer versus Kramer is on. Right. And we...
Kids were crying, parents getting divorced, yelling and screaming at each
other. And we were obsessed. We watched Kramer versus Kramer probably 25 times. And then we watched Annie Hall. And then we watched, you know, Romancing the Stone. And it was like, we got very interested in like adult problems and feelings when we were like 8 years old.
Sexual politics.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, our friends were like talking about land speeders, and we were talking about like Woody Allen's feelings.
Yeah,
in Manhattan.
We didn't watch Star Wars.
Like, we didn't like it.
It was interiors for us. Like, that's really what it was, you know?
That and documentaries in general. I mean, American movie was like a huge influence for us, because Mark and I, we were able to figure out right away that like, you don't have to murder 10 people to get people's attention in a documentary. It's fucking real, and you have to take it seriously. And that's something that we didn't actively put in, but if you saw The Celebration, the first year The Celebration came out, you were like, is this real? No, it's not real, because they film it. No, this is real. This is real. No, it's not real, you know. And it heightened everything so much so that it made us excited about reaching a new sort of level of naturalism and realism.
The Duplass brothers talk structure, production, improvisation, and offer advice to emerging filmmakers.
We are very, very strict about structure, because our feeling is if you're going to be as shaggy and loose in your execution style as we are with our camera work, with our, you know, kind of like mumbling dialogue and how people talk for long times and not succinct ways, you should have a really solid bedrock to the trajectory of your narrative, you know? So if there are 48 scenes on the script, you're going to probably see 48 scenes in our movie. And if those scenes are about going from point A to point B to point C, those things are never going to change. How they might get there, the different approaches, a different tone. We like to take the natural chemistry of actors into account. For instance, with Baghead, you know, there's like a lot, there's four main characters, a lot of different relationships. We saw that there was some special chemistry between Greta Gerwig and our friend Steve Zissou. So we started to amp up how much time, screen time those guys would have. Didn't change the amount of scenes they had, didn't change the nature of that dynamic. We just gave them a little more, you know, it's kind of set up like an accordion a little bit, so you can kind of like stretch it in and out. There are certain things that just happen. And there's all, inevitably those 5 to 10 lines that everybody loves in the script that you try and make work or whatever. But I find that if you take the pressure off of yourself to nail dialogue, you will also get some ancillary benefits because you'll be writing quickly. And, you know, we, in terms of the actual writing of our scripts, the first draft tends to come out in about a week. It's just really quickly. That's after everything's been structured. Yeah, you get some not so perfect dialogue, but sometimes you get like incredible pacing because of that too, because you're sort of living the movie for a week, you know. It's about getting to that really solid 95 to 97% phase and then not beating yourself up to make it the most eloquent one-line zinger of all time.
If there are interactions with people in a fairly controlled environment, we don't shot list anything. But we've found that when we have to do complex stuff, shooting on the water, or
if someone's following someone through a neighborhood and you're seeing them peer around a building, watching them disappear and a car has to come, you know, that stuff we do shot list.
And we do shot list more now because we are working with studios and you don't want to turn around and there's like 40 trailers in your shot, you know, which happens. And Mark and I get pissed off sometimes on studio films because we're on set and something happens and we're like, God damn it. Let's go over here. But there's, you know, literally a bunch of toilets and like, you know, food and stuff over there. So, I mean, that's a big part of logistics now for us in the studio system is
all the shit.
Mark and I are constantly pushing, like the location managers are always annoyed with us because they're like, can we put this right here? And we're just like, can it be around the corner? And they're like, yeah, but it's harder and we have to way more cable. And we're just like, let's do it. And then every once in a while,
what happens if while someone's improvising they go over there? You're gonna lose it.
You know? Yeah, you're gonna lose
it. We'd like to be open to that. When I was working on The League, when I work on that TV show, I definitely discovered something where it's like, okay, maybe it's not always great to improvise the like exposition moment when someone introduces themselves and walks in a house. Maybe it's okay to plan that because you're not going to get that many great surprises out of improvising that. And I learned that by frustration while we were improvising one of those scenes. But like when I was with Noah, you know, our process is just different. Like he gets his scripts to 100%, you know, and he hears his words and they're a song in his head and he knows how they go. The scenes I had there, all of them, name drop, we're with Ben Stiller, who is a big improviser. And so there was like a little bit of like, can we get some of this? So we came up with a system on that thing where we would do all the takes on script. And then our last take, we would improvise it a little bit. And he used a good amount of that stuff, actually, you know. But there's actually not a ton of crossover from like what I do as an actor, you know, to what Jay and I are doing. We're pretty kind of getting pretty solidified in our process.
I mean, to say it really bluntly, it's free to make films now. This was not the case 10 years ago for us to make a short film cost $800 minimum. There is no excuse for not making a short film every month, because I think what happens is people get caught up in their heads like we do. They think about shit forever, and then it's a year later, and they're like, I'm tired of this idea anyways. Just make lots of stuff digitally on a 5D and keep making it, and know that it's all about story and acting. And honestly, just keep making it until other people stop you. Do you know what I'm saying? Because if you make it, usually what happens is people are like, I made this, so it's good, so you have to watch it. And then you give it to your friends, and they don't say anything. Trust me, when you make something that's new and fresh and unique, people will stop you. They will say, what the fuck was that? what were you doing there? They'll start asking you questions and they'll start forcing you to put it in film festivals. And they'll, that's,
people get a little caught up in like, I should be better at marketing my stuff. We're like, don't worry about that. You spend your time making your stuff. And then when it's good, like the marketing will take care of itself. A lot of people really, they're at the C plus or B minus part of their creative career. And they're like, I need to be better about YouTube and I'll get a Twitter account. And it's like, you're just going to mass market your vision as it's half formed. Like get all the way there and then leave it on a street corner and you'll be fine. Like somebody's going to find it and like put it out there.
And people are so terrified that they're going to make something great and no one's going to notice it. That is not going to happen. Because as we all know, films suck. They're terrible. You go to a multiplex and half of them suck. So, you know, you make something that's new and good. It doesn't even have to be great. It just has to be really good and really unique and executed well.
That's been told to us over and over by the film festival programmers, by studio heads, by executives.
And we've seen it.
You can see it. It's real. When you walk into those meetings, they're dying to find somebody who has something interesting to say. They feel like there's a lack of talent everywhere out there. And, you know, so
we got our film in a Sundance. And we went to probably 150 film festivals after that that invited us and took us in free because they saw it at Sundance and they were like, this is the film. We want this film. And, you know, we met even the short film buyers, like Megan at Adam Films at the time was like the major short film buyer. And we were like, why is everybody so obsessed? They're like, they're obsessed with our film. And like, our film can't play every film festival this year. And she's like, oh, yes, it can. And we were like, well, why? And she's like, because basically every year there are only 50 great short films that are made. She's like, they make 20,000 of them. And she's like, and I see half of them. And there's only 50 of them.
She also gave us the greatest short film advice that we try to pass on. Greatest short film advice I ever got in one sentence, which is that it's very hard to program films with a big running time at film festivals. So her advice is make shorts, not longs. And that is like, that's the best advice we ever got. If you can make something that is preferably 8 minutes or under, it's so much easier for them to program and you got a better shot. The 35 minute drama is pretty much the kiss of death. Like that's really the rough one.
We have a new term for it. It's called a schlong.
Yeah, schlong.
Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast is brought to you by Austin Film Festival. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan. Today's podcast was produced and edited by Brian Ramos. For more information on the podcast, On Story, the television show, and Austin Film Festival, go to www.onstory.tv or www.austinfilmfestival.com.